Today I want to look at Genesis chapter 24 through to chapter 36. And this deals largely with the history of Isaac and then his son Jacob. And what it tells us is how the covenant promises that were given to Abraham passed on now through his son Isaac, and then they passed on through his son Jacob. In chapter 24, Abraham realizes that Isaac is getting older and should really have a wife, so that the opportunity is there for them to produce offspring so that the promise can be carried on. But Abraham doesn't want Isaac to take a wife from among the Canaanite people where they were living. At this stage they are still living somewhere around Hebron there in the Negev in the south of Canaan, because the Canaanite people were under God's judgment. So Abraham said to his servant, I want you to go north, back up to the land of Aram, where Abraham had stopped previously on his way through into Canaan in the first place, and all his relatives and friends were back up there. Go back up to Aram. In fact, they went to the region of Paddan Aram, where Abraham's relatives had settled, and take a wife for Isaac from among my relatives there, but don't take one from among the Canaanite people. Also, make sure that Isaac stays here. The idea of sending the servant to get the wife was so that Isaac wouldn't leave Canaan. He'd stay there in the land of God's promise, lest he be tempted to set up home in some other place. You find that referred to in chapter 24, verse 3, where Abraham said to his servant, I make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and of the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell, but will go to my country and to my kindred up there in the north. Also in verse 6, Abraham said to him, and see to it that you don't take my son up there with you. Leave him behind. Well, the servant goes up there, and the rest of chapter 24 is a very interesting story of how the servant found a wife for Isaac. The woman's name was Rebekah. The servant brought Rebekah back. He married Isaac, and then they lived in that area somewhere in the Negev around Hebron. Before we leave Abraham and continue the story with Isaac, chapter 25 rounds off the history of Abraham. Abraham had several wives and many children. We know that he had taken Hagar, the servant, as a wife, and through her had produced Ishmael, and then through Sarah, his real wife, he had produced Isaac. But chapter 25 tells us that during the years he had had another woman called Keturah and a number of children through her. These people were not correct in having all these wives. Don't get the idea that all the people you read about in the Bible are perfect. The only person you read about in the Bible who's perfect is Jesus Christ. These other people may have been men of God, but unfortunately they had many lapses and they copied the ways of the people round about them. It was plain wrong for Abraham to have these several wives. The Arab people of today trace their ancestry back through Ishmael to Hagar to Abraham. They might be hard-pressed proving it, but certainly their spiritual ancestry they trace back to Abraham through Ishmael. And you might say the whole of the Muslim movement, which has been in great conflict with Christianity over the years, all resulted from that one false step of Abraham in taking that other wife. And here likewise with Keturah, the daughters born, or the sons rather, born to Abraham and Keturah became leaders of various Arab tribes around that region. Notice the names Medan and Midian in verse 2. I mention that because later on in the story of Joseph, when Joseph was sold to traders, sometimes they are called Ishmaelites, sometimes Midianites, and sometimes Medanites. Well, the Ishmaelites, the Medanites, and the Midianites were all descended from Abraham. They all intermarried, and it's quite likely that some people belong to two of the clans, and that the groups mingle together. So really, it's the same group that's being spoken about there, just under these different names. These people, Abraham gave them gifts, and as he had sent off Ishmael earlier, so he sent off these other sons, so that they could dwell in various parts of the country. But Isaac was to remain in Canaan, that he might receive the inheritance there. Isaac now grows up, he's married, he and Rebekah have been married for some years without children, and we skip over now a number of years until we come to the time when their first children were born. There were two children born to them, Esau and Jacob. Esau was the older of the two, he was red-headed, and that's why he was called Esau or Edom, that's what the word meant, red. The younger was Jacob, who later became known as Israel, and in due course these were to become the forefathers of great nations, Jacob the father of Israel and Esau the father of Edom. Now before the children were born, in chapter 25 verse 23, God said to Rebekah, two nations are in your womb and two peoples born of you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, Israel shall be stronger than Edom, and the elder shall serve the younger, Esau shall serve Jacob. Well, they were born, and they grew up to become young men. I guess we're another 20 years on now, further in the story. And it turns out that Isaac made a favourite of Esau, and Rebekah made a favourite of Jacob. And so that's heading for trouble. When one parent makes a favourite of one child, and another parent makes a favourite of another child, you must get trouble in the family. Esau was a rather irresponsible sort of a chap, whereas Jacob was a very intense sort of a person. Jacob was also very ambitious, and he was determined to get the birthright from Esau. Now, the birthright was what normally went to the eldest in the family. He got double the inheritance of everybody else. If, for example, there were five children, the inheritance was divided into six, and the eldest got two portions, and the others got one each. Jacob, being an ambitious and intense sort of man, he wanted to get that birthright. Esau was a fairly irresponsible character, and when he came in tired and worn out after a hard day's work, Jacob saw just the opportunity to get the birthright from him. Esau said, "Oh, what's the matter? I've run down and tired." "Yes, you can have the birthright. Just give me a good feed as long as I can relax." And so that way Jacob managed to sneak the birthright from his brother Esau. It also meant, of course, that not only would he receive the extra inheritance, but he would become the head of the family as well. And in the case of this inheritance, it means the forefather of a great nation and the title deed to this land of Canaan. Now, God had appointed, as we read in the previous verse, verse 23, God had appointed that the elder would serve the younger. It was God's will that Jacob should get the birthright instead of Esau. But that is no excuse for the way they behaved. That doesn't excuse Jacob's ruthlessness and doesn't excuse Esau's irresponsibility. Never let us say, "Oh, it's God's will," and that excuses people's faults or wrongdoings. It was God's will that Jesus Christ should die. But that doesn't mean that those who put him on the cross are thereby exonerated. They're still guilty for the way they attacked him and treated him. Never use this "God's will" sort of thing as a means of trying to excuse ourselves. Some person may do something wrong and may accuse me of all sorts of wrongdoings which are not true, and he may persecute me. And these things God uses to teach me. This is part of God's training, God's will for me, to make me a better person than I was previously. But that does not justify that person for the wrongdoing which he does. When you come to chapter 26, very soon Isaac's faith is tested concerning this land which he has now inherited, just as Abraham's was tested. There was a famine in the land. But in the case of Isaac, he doesn't go to Egypt, as Abraham had done, but rather he remains there in the Negev. In 26 verse 1, it tells us there was a famine in the land, as previously in the days of Abraham, and Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines. Now, Abraham previously had also gone to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. The word Abimelech is not the name of a person. It's the title of the Philistine king. Every king of the Philistines was called Abimelech, just like every king of Egypt was called Pharaoh. If you count up the years, and there are all sorts of dates running through these chapters, if you add them all up, you'll find that the story is at least 80 years further on from the time that Abraham went to Abimelech at Gerar. Well, Isaac went to Abimelech there in Gerar. He did not go to Egypt. He maintained his faith in the land which God had promised. And in verse 2, the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give all these lands." And so there's the promise now passing on. God gave the promise to Abraham. Now he passes it on to his son Isaac. "I will be with you and your descendants." So there's the promise of the land and the people. And he goes on to say in verse 4 that "I'll make a multitude of descendants of you as the stars of the heaven." And at the end of verse 4, "By your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." And so there again you have the same three features: the promise of the people are going to dwell in the land, and they're going to produce the Saviour through whom the whole world will be blessed. The blessing then is passed on from Abraham now to his son Isaac. In verse 23 of chapter 26, Isaac eventually moves from Gerar back up to Beersheba. In due course, Isaac passes the blessing on to his son Jacob. We come to the well-known story of how Jacob deceived Isaac in order to get the blessing. Now, the blessing is different from the birthright. The birthright is the right to the inheritance. The blessing is something which the father gave towards the end of his life, which confirmed the birthright. He didn't change anything. But in those days, everybody wanted to get a blessing and nobody wanted to get a cursing, because it's common right through the Old Testament that blessings and cursings were taken very seriously. Today, we think a blessing is something like good luck to you, or a curse is a string of bad language. But in Old Testament times, that was not it. Both the blessing and the curse were believed to carry with them the force, sort of a prophecy, to make those things come true. And Jacob, or everybody really, wanted the father's blessing, so that the things that were announced upon him were a sort of guarantee that when he came into the inheritance, all these things would flourish. Now Isaac knew that Jacob was the one to receive the blessing. We saw it further back. God had said before they were born that the younger will be the leader and the elder's got to serve the younger. But Esau, the elder of the two boys, was Isaac's favourite son. And Isaac decided that he would sneak in a blessing for Esau, almost as if he was trying to fight against what God had decreed should happen. Now Isaac's wife Rebekah was one of the best keyhole listeners that we read about in the Bible. She seems to have known what was afoot all the time, and she got wind of the fact that Isaac was planning to bless Esau. So she ran to her favourite son Jacob and said, "Look, beat him to it." Isaac by this time was getting old, and they thought he was going to die. Actually, they badly miscalculated, because you find he lived on for another 20 years. But never mind, I thought he was going to die, and he was blind, so they said, "We can put one over him." She said to Jacob, "Disguise yourself as Esau, go in there, put on the right voice, say the right things, and get the father's blessing." So Jacob did it, and he got Isaac's blessing. Afterwards, of course, Esau comes in and finds that he's been beaten to the punch, and he's very disappointed over it all, naturally. They're all at fault. Isaac is at fault because he was deliberately fighting against what he knew was God's will. Rebekah was at fault because she was a liar and a deceiver. Jacob was at fault because he had the same characteristics as his mother. The whole thing was scheming and skullduggery all the way through. And yet in spite of this, Jacob received the blessing as God had intended. Esau came in and said, "No consolation prize, nothing for me at all." Isaac said, "Well, I'm afraid once the word has gone from my mouth, I blessed him, he's blessed. All I can do for you is give you, a consolation prize. But the real blessing has already gone to your brother Jacob. But as for you, Esau, well," Isaac said, "you will be father of a people, but I'm afraid you're not going to enjoy things as much as Jacob is." He promised in chapter 27, verse 39, that Esau would dwell in a barren country, Edom, which was dry and very rugged and hilly, away from the fatness of the earth shall your dwelling be. This is in contrast to Jacob, who was going to dwell in the well-watered land of Canaan. Esau would have to dwell in this dry, barren country, away from the dew of heaven, and by your sword you shall live. You're going to be a wild people, and you shall serve your brother. But when you break loose, you shall break his yoke from your neck. And as history goes on, there was conflict between the descendants of Esau and the descendants of Jacob. Edom and Israel were frequently in conflict, and for most of the time Israel had the upper hand, but every now and again Edom broke free. But it was never the strong nation that Israel became. So there you have now the two promises, one to Jacob and one to Esau. The land of Edom, the prominent mountain there is Mount Seir. You'll find that referred to as you move through. Well, Esau was not consoled by all this. He was still angry. Even though he had got the second-rate blessing, he was furious that his brother had done the dirty on him like this. And he determined that he was going to kill Jacob. Now once again, Rebekah found out. You couldn't keep anything from Rebekah. She decided that she had spirit Jacob away to safety where Esau couldn't get him. And she thought of a very clever way of doing it. Rather humorous when you think of it. By this time, Jacob had not married, but Esau had. If you go back to the very last verse of chapter 26, you find that Esau had taken two wives. The first of them was called Judith, and she was a Hittite, one of the local Canaanite people. And the other one was Basemath, and she also was a Hittite, one of the local Canaanite people. Verse 35 tells us that they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. So we had some fun in the household with the in-laws not getting on with each other. Now Rebekah thought of a scheme. She came to Isaac in chapter 27, verse 46, and she said to Isaac, "I'm weary of my life because of the Hittite women, our two daughters-in-law. If Jacob marries another Hittite woman, such as these, one of the women of the land, what good will my life be to me? Life will be just so, it won't be worth living if we had three Hittite daughters that were in the house. It's bad enough with two. I suggest that Jacob go and find a wife somewhere else. And in the next verse, chapter 28, verse 1, Isaac leaped up and said, Jacob, come here, quick, quick, quick. And he blessed him and he charged him. He says, don't you marry one of the Canaanite women. We've got two of them, that's enough. You go up to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and find a wife up there. And of course Rebecca sits back smiling and thinking, ah, it worked. She managed to be able to get Jacob out of Esau's way and save his life by sending him off back up to Paddan Aram to find a wife for himself. Oh, she's a schemer, this woman. And she got her own way, and she never saw her favourite son again. And that's it. You can scheme and get all the smart ideas and get your own way and tell lies and deceive, as this woman did. She preserved her favourite son. She got the inheritance for her favourite son. Everything she wanted for her favourite son she got, and in the end she lost him. And off he went, and it was over 20 years before he came back. And by the time he got back, Rebecca had died. Sometimes tragic, you know, that you get your own way. It can be your undoing in the long run if you go about it the wrong way. Isaac, by this time, was resigned to the fact that Jacob was indeed going to get the blessing, and you find now in chapter 28 that he gives Jacob the blessing once again. Now, the first time he'd given the blessing to Jacob, he had been deceived in doing it. So the second time he does it, he gives the blessing willingly and knowingly. So he says in verse 3, Isaac says to Jacob, God Almighty bless you, my son, and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may become a company of peoples. May he give the blessing of Abraham to you and to your descendants with you, that you may take possession of the land of your sojournings which God gave to Abraham. And so off went Jacob to find his wife up north. Esau, meanwhile, went and took to himself another wife. He had found out that his parents didn't like his present Hittite wives, so he thought he'd add another one to the collection, hoping that she might please them. And in verse 9 it tells us that Esau went to Ishmael and took to wife, besides the ones he already had, a woman called Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son. So really, by taking one of Ishmael's daughters as his wife, remembering that Ishmael had already been cut off from the covenant, Esau was in fact confirming himself as being outside the covenant. So that's the end of the story of Esau for the time being. We now follow Jacob north and see what happens when he got up there among his relatives in Paddan Aram. On the way, he stopped at Bethel. He left from around Beersheba or Hebron or wherever they were. He stopped at Bethel, and there, in a dream, God passed on the Abrahamic blessings to him. God gave them to Abraham, he passed them on to Isaac, now he passes them on to Jacob. Chapter 28, verse 13. The Lord said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and your descendants. Your descendants shall be like the dust of the earth, and shall spread abroad to the west, east, north, and south. By you and your descendants all the families of the earth shall be blessed. You see the same three features: the land, the people, and ultimately the Saviour of the world. Jacob moves up north, and by some very daring exploits and a little bit of male chivalry, he manages to present himself to his uncle Laban. Now Laban is the brother of his mother Rebekah. When he goes to Laban, he finds that Laban has some rather attractive daughters. One of them, called Rachel, he wants to marry. She is one of the younger daughters. And Laban says, all right, you can marry Rachel, provided you work 7 years as the payment of the bride price. Jacob said, fair enough. So he worked his 7 years. Then came the wedding ceremony, and in those days they were veiled and they went through various ceremonies just as we do today, but in a different form. So he got suitably betrothed and suitably married to this woman, and when it was all over and he lifted the veil, lo and behold, it wasn't Rachel at all. It was Rachel's older sister Leah, who frankly wasn't terribly attractive. And Laban saw that this was a good chance to unload his eldest daughter. Jacob, of course, was disappointed, to put it very mildly. And after the week's wedding festivities were over, Jacob said, look, can I still have the other one as well? Laban said, all right, you can have her, so here she is, but you've got to work another 7 years. So he got his second wife on the spot. So he had the two of them now, but he still had to work the extra 7 years for Rachel. Although you feel a little sorry for the chap, I say, serves him jolly well right. The chickens have come home to roost. If you work some skullduggery on somebody else, sooner or later somebody's going to do the same on you, and it'll turn out worse for you than what you had done to somebody else. Jacob had done the wrong thing by Esau. He had deceived his father. He had deceived Esau. He had lied, and now he's getting a taste of his own medicine. There's a principle you'll get right through the Bible: what you sow, you'll reap. Never forget it. Well, he has his wives, and he paid most of his attention to Rachel. Leah got left out in the cold. But Jacob eventually was forced to pay some attention to Leah because Rachel couldn't produce any children, and Jacob badly wanted some sons. Leah, therefore, eventually produced a son for him, and then a second, and the next year another one, and a fourth. So now Leah, the unattractive wife, has got four sons, and Rachel, the favourite wife, still hasn't any. Well, Rachel then decides that she's going to get some sons somehow. One of the wedding gifts which Laban had given to his daughters when they married Jacob was to give each of them a servant. You'll find in chapter 29, verse 34, that he gave his maid Zilpah to Leah as her wedding gift, and in verse 29 he gave his maid Bilhah to Rachel as her wedding gift. So what Rachel said was what previously Sarah had said to Abraham: I can't produce children. Take my maid, see if you can produce a child through her. The child so born will become mine. Because it was a great shame to be married and not to have children. So she said to Jacob, here's my maid. Well, Jacob was able to produce a son through this maid. And then the next year, another son. And so Rachel said, well, in effect, I've got these two as my sons. Even though I didn't produce them with my body, my maid did, and so I'll call them my sons. It's not quite the same thing, is it? Leah says, I've got four, and now she's got two. She's starting to catch up. What I'll do, she was getting on in years now, and she thought, I don't really want to have any more babies, but I'll give my maid to Jacob. And so we get another son, and another son. So now there are six plus two. Rachel, of course, is getting more and more frustrated as the years go on. Now one day, Reuben, who was the eldest of all these sons, he happened to come across some plants in the field called mandrakes. These mandrakes are very rare sorts of plants, and they were believed to, if you mixed them up and boiled them in water and things like that, you could make some sort of fertility drug out of them. And so women who couldn't have children, if they drank this at the appropriate time, maybe could get pregnant. Reuben brought them home, and his mother Leah saw them. Rachel found out about it, and she said, oh, give me the mandrakes, because this might just solve my problem, and I might get that baby I've always wanted. But Leah, who had been left out in the cold because Jacob always loved Rachel, she said, I'll strike a deal with you. I'll give you the mandrakes if you let me have a night with Jacob. So Rachel said, all right, I'll do it. So she took the mandrakes and made herself her fertility potion, whatever you like to call it. And the irony of the whole thing is that the mandrakes did nothing at all for Rachel, and Leah got pregnant again. And next year again. So now she has two more sons, and then she had a daughter. So by now Jacob has a total of 10 sons and one daughter, a girl called Dinah, and Rachel still doesn't have any. Well, anyway, the story ends on a happy note. Eventually Rachel did have a son, and of course the son born to her became Jacob's favourite son. His name was Joseph. Well, now with this house full of children, Jacob is feeling, what might you say, has a fairly substantial household, and his future is guaranteed. With 10 sons, you've got a fair chance that your family name will be passed on. So he decides the time has come for him to up and return to Canaan. He's been there by this time 14 years, at least. He went to Laban, his father-in-law and uncle, Uncle Dad or Uncle Laban or Dad Laban or whatever he called him. It gets a bit complicated when your uncle is your father-in-law. And he said, I'd like to return home. By this time, Jacob had been very clever at raising flocks and herds and had made Laban very rich, felt that it was his due that he should get some sort of payment. He'd worked 14 years for his family, and Laban said to him, it's only fair that you should take some payment, because I really have become very wealthy because of your expertise in the field of animal husbandry. Clever in not only ordinary husbandry, but animal husbandry as well. What do you want? Jacob said, I'll claim as my wages all the animals in your flocks and herds, the sheep and the goats, that is, all the animals among your sheep and the goats that are part-coloured, spotted, speckled, or patched, or striped, or something like that. You can have all the one-coloured ones, and I'll have all the part-coloured ones. I'll also have the black sheep, and there aren't many black sheep. Laban did some quick mental calculation and found out that that would be a fairly good deal, because most of the animals were probably one-coloured, and so he said, all right, you can do that. But you find that in chapter 30, verse 35, before Jacob could go through the flocks and collect all his animals, Laban got to them first. That very day, Laban removed all the he-goats that were striped and spotted, and all the she-goats he could find that were speckled and spotted, every one that had white on it, every lamb that was black, and he put them in charge of his own sons, because he was frightened that when Jacob went, he might take so much of the property with him that there'd be no inheritance left for Laban's own sons. Jacob found out about it, and so you have this battle going on between these two tricksters. They don't have much principle between the two of them. So you find now that what Jacob says is, I'll stay around a few more years just to help you make sure the farm goes well. And in all, he stayed another 6 years. And what he did over those 6 years was to breed Laban's flocks in such a way that he chose the best of the animals to breed so that the offspring would be spotted or speckled or something like that. And then all the worst of the animals, he bred them together so that they produced one coloured offspring. And in this way, of course, Laban's share got smaller and smaller and Jacob's got greater and greater. After a while, Laban woke up to what was happening. Jacob thought, I'll strike while the iron's hot, let's go. Now his wives, Leah and Rachel, they were on Jacob's side because they realized that their father despised them by now, and all he was working for was to build up the inheritance for the sons. And they were going to get cut out of the inheritance because Laban thought, they're married to Jacob and he's wealthy enough, so why should I give them any of my inheritance? I'm going to divide my inheritance among my sons. So Leah and Rachel supported Jacob and they said, yes, our father has done the wrong thing by us. He used our bride price in the first place to make himself rich, and now he's not going to give us any of the inheritance. That's what they say in chapter 31, verse 14. They said to Jacob, is there any portion or inheritance left to us in our father's house? Are we not regarded by him as foreigners? He has sold us, and he has been using up the money which was given for us, our bride price. All the property which God has taken away from our father, it really belongs to us and to our children. So then, Jacob, you do whatever God has said you should do. So Jacob said, all right, we'll up and off and we'll migrate back down there to Canaan. Now Rachel, she also was a bit of a schemer. In fact, she was worse than that. She was a thief. Because in verse 19, while Laban was out shearing his sheep, Rachel stole her father's household gods. And the point of that was that the household gods gave the person who possessed them the right to the inheritance. This is one of the ancient customs they had. And she thought, if I have the possession of those household gods, that's a further strength to me that we have the right to claim this inheritance. When Laban gets back and he finds that Jacob and all his household have cleared out, he goes after them. And when he meets them, we have the discussions and altercations going on there. And in verse 30, he says, you have gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house. Well, that's fair enough. You can go if you want to go back home to your relatives. But why did you steal my gods? That was the thing he was most upset about, because he knew that whoever had taken his gods had pulled the rug from under his sons who were hoping to get the inheritance. Well, we find that he wasn't able to locate his gods, so Jacob, Leah, Rachel, their children, their animals, the whole great company, the whole caravan moved off. But before they moved off, Laban and Jacob entered into a sort of non-aggression pact. They made a covenant between them that neither would attack the other, because they were equally as scheming as each other. So in chapter 31, verse 49, they got a heap of stones and made a pillar, which they called Mizpah. For they said, the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from each other. That doesn't mean to say two lovers are parting from each other and they want to be loyal to each other. What it meant was, the Lord watch between you and me so that we don't get at each other's throats. Verse 52, this heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, that I will not pass over this heap to you, and you will not pass over this pillar to me for harm. Having come to some sort of honour among thieves agreement, they parted. Jacob now heads off back down south, and he comes to the river Jabbok. You can see on the map there, he has to cross the river Jabbok, and we find they camp the night at a place called Penuel. If Jacob is going to live in Canaan in peace, he knows that first of all he's got to put things right with Esau. It's 20 years since he cleared out, but he knew that Esau would have remembered all that had happened, and if he wanted to live safely in Canaan, he had to put things right with Esau. So you find that what he does, with his usual cunning and skill, he divides the whole caravan up into bits and pieces and sends them off one by one, so that if Esau came out furiously starting to slaughter anybody, at least not the whole lot would be lost. He didn't put all his eggs in one basket, in other words. and he hoped that this way he would appease Esau. But before he went to Esau, we find in chapter 32, verse 24, that as he's asleep that night, he has an encounter with a man, a superhuman person, the angel of the Lord, once again, I would suggest. Chapter 32, verse 24, Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh, and Jacob's thigh was put out of joint as he wrestled with the man. And he said, "Let me go," the man said, "for the day is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man said to him, "What's your name?" He said, "Jacob," which means supplanter or trickster or something like that. He said, "Your name shall no more be called Jacob, but Israel. You're going to be God's champion. God's going to change you." The point of the story is this. Jacob, as usual, was determined to win. And Jacob's philosophy in life was, you win at all costs. As long as you achieve what you want to achieve, you walk all over everybody else, but you win at all costs. He was still determined to win even when he was wrestling with this man. But now he had to learn that against God he could not win. You might think you're tough and you can fight everybody else and get your own way, but sooner or later you've got to be brought to the point where you realize that against God you will never win. And this is what Jacob had to learn. He met God and he was defeated. His proud self-confidence at last was broken down. Yet on the other hand, he did achieve a victory, because in being conquered by God, he himself won a victory. He won a victory over himself. His persistence also proved he was made of stern stuff. And so Jacob the cheat is now turned into Israel, God's champion. That's the point we've got to come to, where we, you might say, are broken by God. And instead of being self-willed and determined and self-confident and arrogant, eventually God teaches us that we cannot go on like this, and it's he who changes us. And it was God who changed Jacob. And from this point on, Jacob is a different man. He's had his encounter with God. He's had this great spiritual experience. But because you've had a great spiritual experience, it doesn't mean to say you're not going to have any more problems in life. Our spiritual experiences are not some sort of way of getting out of life's problems. All they mean is that we can handle life's problems better. Jacob's spiritual experience as he wrestled with God didn't alter the fact that he still had to face Esau the next day. So he went on and he met Esau, and lo and behold, the dreaded meeting turned into a happy reunion. Esau harbored no ill feelings. But we find, if you read the story on, that although Jacob had gained Esau's birthright, he had done so by guile and deceit, and God did not allow Jacob to enjoy that birthright until he had looked Esau in the eyes, confessed his sin, and admitted, and then confessed and acknowledged that Esau was the one who really had the right to it. But then Esau willingly said, "What's past is past. You're welcome to it." You see, God brings us back and he makes us face up to these things eventually. It may be 20 years, but the chickens will come home to roost sooner or later, and we have to face up to those things. All your great spiritual experiences aren't going to be a way of avoiding those unpleasant confrontations that we have to have as we face up to the wrongs that our own stupidity or selfishness or greed have created. Well, we find they parted friends. In chapter 33, verse 17, Jacob moved nearby to a place called Succoth. Succoth was just near Penuel, and he settled down there for a while. Now, all the while, Jacob and all his sons are growing and getting older. His sons are getting married, and they're producing children, and so the household is enlarging. After he'd been in Succoth for a while, in chapter 33, verse 18, he crosses the Jordan River and comes into the land of Canaan. Now, that's very important, because now, after all these years, he's back in the land that God had promised. And in verse 19, once he comes into Canaan, he buys from the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money, the piece of land on which he had pitched his tent. He made the same demonstration of faith as Abraham had made earlier. "This is the land that you have promised me," he said to God. "I want to demonstrate my faith by buying myself a few square meters and owning it now." We don't own the lot yet. It'll be our descendants who will own the lot. But we believe that they will own the lot one day. And just to put our money where our mouth is, I'm going to take that money and I'm going to buy this block of land, because this is a foretaste of the fact that one day we'll all own this land. So he demonstrates his faith as his grandfather Abraham had done previously. Well, he's now settled there in Shechem. Oh, there was a rather unsavory story there in chapter 34. Dinah, the daughter, by now had become a very attractive young woman. One of the men of Shechem raped her, and her brothers, Dinah's brothers, the sons of Jacob, played a very dirty trick on the men of Shechem, and as a result had a real bloodbath and slaughtered hosts of them. Not a very savoury story at all. It's there in chapter 34. Brought Jacob much shame. But in chapter 35, God said to Jacob, "Go back to Bethel and dwell there, and make there an altar to the God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Esau." Remember back at the beginning, when Jacob fled from Esau, that night as he slept at Bethel, God made the promise to him that he would bring him back into this land and he would have descendants from whom the Saviour would come. Well, he goes back there to Bethel. We've gone full cycle, and God reconfirms the promises to him in chapter 35, verse 11. God said to him, "I am the God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply, a nation and a company of nations shall come from you, kings shall spring from you. The land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you, and I will give the land to your descendants after you." And so now the blessing is passing on. Jacob and his family are back established in the land, and the covenant promises are reconfirmed of a land and a people. The rest of the chapter winds up the story of Jacob to this point. Rachel had another son, that's Jacob's 12th son, and he was called Benjamin. Sadly, Rachel passed away in giving childbirth, but Benjamin, the child, lived on, and so he and Joseph, the two sons of Rachel, understandably were Jacob's favourite sons. There's another incident worth noting in verse 22, because it will be referred to later on, and it crops up in a few other books of the Bible. That is that Reuben, the eldest of all the children, we're not sure whether he raped Bilhah or whether it was by mutual agreement, but it was a pretty horrible thing to do, seeing she was, in effect, his stepmother. It says in verse 22 that while Israel dwelt in that land, Reuben went in and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. And because of that sin, we're going to find later on that Reuben lost his right to the birthright, although he was the eldest of the family. It was so gross a sin that he forfeited his right to the birthright, which should normally have been his. We'll see that tomorrow as we come to the final section. And then chapter 36 wraps up the section by telling us a few details concerning the descendants of Esau. Tomorrow we'll look at the final part of Genesis, which is chapter 37 through to the end, and it tells us how these 12 sons of Jacob now carried on the story, and how the blessings which we've referred to came further towards their ultimate fulfillment.